Okay, so just like you've been asked before, are there any people here who are elected officials? Ah, there's one other elected official in the room. Excellent. Take nothing personally that I will say here today. It just comes with the program. And so like the others, I have no relationships to disclose. So how many people in this room find it absolutely fabulous to work with the elected official in your area on whatever it is you're trying to accomplish? Raise your hands. Okay, there are at least a few of them here. One of them is my own health director, so he doesn't count. So here's the deal. A quick lesson in what happens for elected officials. In many places, elected officials have a job that is separate from their job as a political elected person. That's a problem, because how are they going to focus on all the good work that you're trying to accomplish? One other thing, I get to do everything from soup to nuts. I will do planning and zoning, I will do roads, I will do veterans affairs, I will do budgetary policy, taxing, and public health. Public health isn't the only thing that I do. It's not the only thing that most elected officials do. So you as public health officials, and I happen to talk to a lot of other folks, folks who are emergency managers, folks who are planners, and state hazard mitigation officers, they all hate us. I mean that in some degree of seriousness, because really, you present us with great data and information, and how quickly do we uptake the action that you want to do? How quick are we to fund your initiatives? Probably not near as much as you would like. So what I hope to do is give you a couple of examples of the work that I've been involved in and the opportunities that I think you can seek to create for your elected official so you can be more successful in the important work that you want to do. So a few years back in our community, we found ourselves in the middle of a flood. It had 10 square miles in our downtown core underwater. We evacuated a jail and a hospital. Provided a lot of challenges, and I got really familiar with disasters. As a part of this, I'm a part of the National Academy of Sciences. They wrote a report called Resilience, a National Imperative. And now we're studying three communities, which is really outside of the general purview of NAS. They're looking at Seattle, Charleston, and Cedar Rapids, which is where I'm from. They're very different communities. They have very different risks. And unlike the Rockefeller Foundation, we are not offering $1 million per community. We are actually only offering a number of experts to come in to your community and tell you why you should work harder and do more work to build a resilient community. And the interesting thing is, we think we're making progress. I probably won't be able to tell you that for another couple of years because we won't be done till about 2 years from now. But a lot of this is about trying to help a community understand what are the varieties of risks that they face. And some of those risks aren't just risks related to disasters. They're risks related to what happens if a local employer leaves, what happens if you have a disease come to your community. Many of you were probably involved with H1N1. Some folks may not have been paying attention, but I'm fairly certain most public health folks were. Last year, when we were all dealing with Ebola, the possibility even, it was very stressful. So those are, at their base, resilience initiatives. So here's another thing. I'm a county official. I used to, once upon a time, about a year and a half ago, be the president of the National Association of Counties. And so while I love Philadelphia and Denver and other places like that, and New York, The federal government has taken a very long time to understand that those are actually joint city-county governments. So all the things they expect a city to do everywhere else in the country actually is a county function. We've had to spend a lot. How many people actually work for a county? Okay, so you understand my pain, which is that everybody oftentimes looks to the city and they forget to ask the county. But in fact, we own 960 hospitals, we do 14 million patient days, and we invest over $70 billion in this nation for community health and hospitals. So it helps if you find ways to leverage what you do with your elected official. And I'll give you an example. A friend of mine, Carol Morley, former president of NACHO, actually serves on a NACHO Health Steering Committee for Public Health. So we then help build bridges between those people like you who are actually doing the work with people like me who have to figure out both the policy and how do you get the money to where you want to go. So other things that are keys to county public health, we operate over 12,000 jails. We do public health in the jails, but we're also struggling with mental health problems. About 40% of the people who reside in jails in this nation are there for no other reason than they have a mental health problem. And that is huge. And it intersects a lot with our human service directors. And we need to build better collaboratives between human services and public health. All politics is local. You may have heard that phrase before. But the reality is, a few years ago, and thank you to Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, one, because as Julie knows, I love that they call it the County Health Rankings. It's fabulous. But we were invited to come to some training for the Center for Creative Leadership. And I'm going to talk in a moment about we've been doing the Blue Zones Initiative in our community, and at the time, we decided to bring that to the Center for Creative Leadership. We were looking at food access issues, particularly as it related to schools. So we came thinking we were going to do great work. We were all fired up, and we got there. And within the first day, in that setting of boundaries and really trying to understand the work that we were doing, we came to know that we were going to go back to our community and we were actually dealing with issues of poverty, of housing, of transportation, of equity, all really easy issues for me as an elected official to get up that hill. It is not easy to do this work because in this hyper-political world that we live in and the 24/7 news cycle, you know that you are doing good work and you know that you have a lot of data to prove it. But I will tell you that if I go out in the community and I try to use that data to convince people, I will generally fail. So that's because people, sadly, everyday people, don't necessarily want to know the data. This is very depressing, I know, because I live it every day. You know the social determinants of health. You know the impact of the zip code of where people live. I know when I tell that to someone in my community, they will say, I don't want to hear that. So I have to find a different way to talk about this. And it has been helpful, although, it's done by the Wellmark Foundation. We brought in the Blue Zones. And so we had to actually work with our newspaper to help them, because I couldn't even get them to do any publicity on this. We were chosen as a Blue Zones community. It was really cool. And their response was, oh, it's just because the governor wants to get publicity for his Healthy State Initiative. And it's a Wellmark Foundation gig. No. So we actually sat down and talked with our newspaper about how could they do the arc of the story differently. How could we get buy-in? And in a perfect example of what Julie talks about, we couldn't even find anyone to take the leadership on this. I knew it couldn't be me because this was focused on the community of Cedar Rapids, and oh, by the way, I'm a county supervisor. And I do serve on my Board of Health. But I needed someone who had the bully pulpit. So I learned a couple of things. I haven't substantially went to a Blue Zones meeting. I remember I'd gotten some emails from a very nice woman I know at the United Way, and I'd not really paid attention to it. And it was, we were going to have a big Blue Zones kickoff meeting. I said, Eugenia, you're going to send this email again, only it's going to come from me. And suddenly, we had a much larger audience. And in the audience was the mayor. And he and I have a pretty good relationship. And I said, Mayor, it's you. You have to be the lead. You have to get out there and do this. The business community was scared to death in the chamber that somehow they were going to be caught taking all the responsibility. So to the issues of trust and buffering and all those things you have to do, part of our early work in doing this was to get through those phases. Not that Blue Zones isn't a really great idea, but we had to cover a lot of what I call beginning ground. So like I said, data is really useful, but I will tell you, I am a politician. And so I like to use stories. And I'm going to use an example from 2 weeks ago. I happened to be at Harvard. I was doing a human services summit. I would recommend a book to you called Leadership on the Line by Ron Heifetz and Marty Linsky. It really helps you understand what you need to do to be a leader in today's world. And God forbid I would ever use the word leader and Ron and Marty's name in the same sentence, because they don't believe that anyone is a leader, but rather you exercise leadership. And exercising leadership requires you to understand where your ego intersects the reality of what you need to do. And as an elected official, you do not have to be the one that is always getting it done. But in my example about the Blue Zones, you can be the convener. So here's the story that Ron told. How many people remember Moses? Okay, we all sort of somewhere went to church and we may have some perspective on Moses. So here's the deal. The story tells us that Moses was approached by God with this really cool project and that he was going to go do wonderful things for his people. And in his conversation with God, he said, I'm not really very good as a speaker. He said, that's okay, your brother is. So he's going to be your speaker. And I'm going to give you these really cool tools. I'm going to give you a burning bush. I'm going to give you a staff. I'm going to give you the ability to do magic. And you are going to help your people get free. Well, it sounds like a good idea. You know, this is kind of a big deal. You know how easy it is to move people from their home, pick up everything they have, go live somewhere else? Not because they want to, but because someone actually thinks it's a good idea? So lo and behold, Moses actually does manage to get his people free. We all remember Charlton Heston parting the Red Sea. They get out. They get to the promised land. Oh my God, Moses goes up on a hill. And he finds out from God, this first 2 years was barely the beginning of his work. Now they were going to wander for 40 years in the wilderness. Can you imagine what that was like? You thought you had a 2-year job and now you've got a 40-year job? Are you kidding me? Please, may I not be in office for 40 years. But this is why I color my hair. Okay, this work that you are doing and that I hope to do is work that takes extraordinary patience. Some of the work we are doing is changing the world, and it will not happen in the next year, in the next 2 years. If we're lucky, we'll get change in a generation. It is the nature of people to want to use stories. So I encourage you in your work to think about what is the story that your data tells about the family that is immigrated from Somalia and had to deal with a DHS worker who wanted to take their children away because they eat on the floor. But eating on the floor is the cultural perspective of the people who come from Somalia, and they cannot find any food to eat in our community that looks remotely like the food that they grew in Somalia. These are stories that we all have in our community that you can tell to help people understand we're working to get people on a journey to build a healthier environment and to be participants in their community. So you see up here, we did do boundary spanning leadership, and I use it almost every day, I can tell Katie and Julie, and in ways that I never thought I would use. And so, as I said, policymakers can be conveners. Relationships are important. You are public health workers, but that is no reason for you to only work in the realm of public health. What are you doing with businesses? What are you doing with your chamber? What are you doing with certainly your hospitals? What about your human service workers? Because that's the cross sector. And if you live only within public health, you will never ultimately get as much done as you could if it can be done in partnership with others. And that communication is necessary because people have to own this work. It can't be because you have great data and you know what's going on. It has to be because your community owns it, because you have partners who own it, because they believe in the vision that you are trying to build. And as I said, it takes an infinite amount of patience. So I also wanted to share with you a little bit about the human services value curve. So in the human services sector, they're doing a lot of the same things that you are in public health, and they're really trying to understand where do you sit on that values curve. So at the regulative level, you're really trying to discern, for instance, that this person needs SNAP benefits. They may need to go to a clinic and see a health provider. It's really all about what services do I have, what do they need. It's very narrow. Once you move on to a collaborative perspective, you're really looking across service agencies. So you're trying to think, well, who else am I going to have to partner with? Once you move to the integrative level, you're actually asking yourself, what are the root causes? What is the reason that this is happening? Ultimately, I think we generally all agree that there are some key issues related to equity and poverty. And once you get to the generative level, you're talking about a healthy community. You're talking about multidimensional co-creative efforts. You're not always going to operate at that level, but that's your goal, is to create more and more of that. And all of this takes risk. It asks you to go outside of the area in which you are comfortable. Public health is safe. You did all those years, you still are carrying debt from all that education you did. You believe in what you do, and you know you have good data and science behind what you do. But good data and good science will never change this world. It may be the underpinnings of what we use to change this world, but your ability to work with other people and to inspire them with the opportunity to work on building a different kind of community, that is a place I want to be. And I want to be with my public health official. So find a way. I chair my public health board, so Pramod knows he's got me, okay? He knows where to find me. But I've got four other colleagues on the board that I have to convince. So I'm going to tell you one story in closing, and it was actually a huge failure. because sometimes I think we learn more from our failures than we do from our successes. It really will help you understand a lot about politics. Five-member board. We had a CTG grant. We live in Iowa. We had already done no smoking. Our CTG grant was going to really push us into the realm of doing more with reducing tobacco usage. Not just smoking, but tobacco usage. So our research told us there were lots of orbs, toothpicks, certainly e-cigarettes, all of these various delivery systems not yet regulated by FDA. So we got put out on what I call the bleeding edge with not much legal support, and we're trying to craft, what could we do? We managed to put together some resolutions, some policy, and some ordinance. And we're moving along, and we're just praying to God that no one in the state legislature takes a look at us. We were talking a lot with New York City. They believed we had the keys to some of this success. We're quietly moving along. I have a colleague on the board, and I cannot really tell you what the issue was that flipped him, but he got really pissed off at me. At the time, it's interesting, because he used to be of the other party than I now, but he has since switched. But on that particular day, he was so angry that he picked up the phone and he called the tobacco lobby. Oh my God. I have never gotten so many calls on any issue in all my life from all over the country. Any area code that wasn't mine, I ignored. I don't usually do that, but at that particular time I chose to do that. And we had one of our colleagues who I thought was still going to hang strong. I'm counting votes. I think I have three, maybe three and a half. I'm really pretty sure about those three. The calls got to the third vote, and he caved the day before the vote. And so we didn't get it. We didn't get it because he was worried about his own reelection. He was worried about all the local convenience stores, tobacco folks who were figuring out who his friends were that were calling him. And he said, I can't vote for it. I would tell you, I thought Senator Harkin was going to take his head off. So I was actually trying to leverage from some pretty high levels to get him to hold. And he didn't. Sometimes you don't win. Which is why it's really important to map things out ahead of time. We knew that might happen. We did get a lot of things for under 18. We made it really very painful them to think about, you know, really? You want to keep these on the counters for kids who are 18 and younger? So we made some progress, but the politics of any situation is about building relationships, and building relationships across sectors and above and below you in order to build a partnership. So it has been a pleasure to join you today, and I will turn it over to my colleagues. Thank you.